The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. I've been warned that we've got at least one, maybe two Social Security questions we're going to get to first, and then a variety of topics. No more specifics than that I was provided, so that's all I can share with you right now. So luckily we've got some more Social Security questions come in, so we can continue our tradition of starting with those Social Security questions. While Jim is doing the final gathering of his questions, I will remind you, if you want to send in your own questions for the show, you can do that at our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or you can email Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. Jim, are you with me? He's not, because he hasn't turned his microphone on.
Thank you. How'd you know that? Can you hear when I shut it off and don't turn it on when you say something?
Well, I know when there's dead silence. As much as you like to talk, you don't ever wait that long to speak. So if there's silence for more than about 0.1 seconds, I know that you must have a technical issue.
Or I could have been having another stroke on the floor.
It could be, but I would think you could probably bang on the floor a little bit and I'd hear
true,
you in the
true.
Other room.
True, I would have definitely been able to bang on the floor. Yeah. Okay, we are going to lead with a Social Security question, as we kind of like to do. We've gotten a few Social Security questions in. So this one is kind of a unique one, Chris, because I think it's part Social Security, and one could say part financial planning as well.
Hmm. Nice.
I guess technically speaking, all Social Security questions are ultimately financial planning questions as well. But
true. If you're doing it right, if you're focusing on just Social Security as a standalone decision, you're doing it wrong.
Absolutely. We received an email today from someone, a colleague who I know, gave me a little rundown of their situation in four simple sentences and wanted me to tell them if they should claim Social Security the way that they think. And my answer is going to be, I don't know. There's not enough info in what you shared with me. Definitely, I get the impression they were thinking of it in isolation rather than as part of a financial plan.
Yeah. And that's pretty typical, actually. Not necessarily of advisors, but many treat it the same way. But just people, when they're making their own decisions, they tend to look at these retirement decisions as a series of independent decisions, when in fact they should be looked at more comprehensively, how they all fit together. Because it's, you know, I guess kind of like an orchestra. There's all the individual instruments, which have their own special characteristics and benefits. But it really is something special when you can put it all together and they're playing together well.
Okay. All righty. Well, we'll begin with our first Social Security question then. Instead of rambling on like you sometimes do, I'm going to keep you on track, and we're going to jump right into the first question. It begins, hello, Jim and Chris. Greetings from the great state. Do you want to guess what great state it is? You got one out of 50.
The great state of Texas?
Did you get this email?
No. But people from Texas tend to be extra proud of their state for Sometimes legitimate reasons. Sometimes I'm wondering what the hell they're talking about.
Well, he is from the great state of Texas, so very good guess. Hello, Jim and Chris, and greetings from the great state of Texas. Again, we're going to call him George, protect his anonymity, but he did give his real name, and I got to give him a shout-out again. I like his name. Okay. He says, I really appreciate your show and the knowledge you guys provide to all of us do-it-yourselfers out here in podcast land. I've listened to just about every Q&A show in the last couple of years and have never heard this question before. And since Chris knows more about Social Security than most people who even work there, now that's quite the shout-out to you. You know more about Social Security than most people who even work there.
Wow.
That's his opinion.
Thanks.
I figured I would ask you guys. Okay, so then he lays out the facts. My wife and I own an employee benefit agency, so we control our W-2 income. She's 52, I'm 45. We are looking at taking her Social Security at 62, so another decade from now, Chris, so I can invest it.
Well, 17 years from now.
No, she's 52.
Oh, I thought he was 52.
No, she's 45. 50. Are you taking notes?
Oh, I'm trying to, but I already got it mixed up. So I got it. A decade from now, I'm following it.
Yeah, she's 52. He's 45.
Okay.
Okay. We are looking, I'll start over. We are looking at taking her Social Security at 62 just to invest it because I can make more investing it than I could ever get from the U.S. government. Now, we'll pause there. And say, that's your prerogative, sir. We don't know enough about your situation to say whether that is true or not. We'll just assume someone from the great state of Texas has crunched the numbers, and you feel strongly on that, but we aren't necessarily supporting that choice. It's fair assessment, Chris?
Fair assessment, but I would point out that you need to look at it properly and calculate what type of return you would have to earn on this money to be
competitive
with what the extra income is going to be from Social Security by waiting. And I think most people do that math incorrectly. And I will say that you will be shocked at the rate of return that is implied by your statement.
Why don't we pause here, folks, and turn this into a rabbit hole that Chris is going to run down like he normally does all the time anyways. So why don't you explain to him, because I know exactly where you're going with this, the rate of return he actually has to earn on that money, in my opinion, to replicate the income that would have been received, say, at her full retirement age of 67 or waiting to 70. And I think that's where you're going with it, right? What would he have to save up to put in perhaps an income annuity to try to replicate the same lifetime income adjusted for inflation forever? Is that where you're going with it?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you explain to him what you mean?
So in my opinion, the correct way to assess this trade-off, because just to clarify for people, the trade-off is take the Social Security early. You don't need it, so you invest it. And hopefully you'll end up in the future in a better place than if you would have waited and taken the Social Security later. And there's a few ways to do this comparison. I think the most common sense way to do it is to look at the extra income that you would be paid from Social Security by waiting, and then ask yourself, how much in assets would I need at that time to replicate that amount of income that they're willing to pay me by waiting? Let me put some simple math to this. So if you're in this particular case, their full retirement age is 67. If you're 52 now, that would be the case. And so that means claiming at 62 would lead you to a reduced benefit of 30%. You're going to have a 30% reduction in your benefit, if you will, by claiming at 62 versus 67. And so I'm doing this math on the fly, so hopefully I don't screw anything up. But if you were to do that, and let's pretend that the benefit at age 67 was expected to be $1,429. So $1,429, and you'll see now why I picked that number, $1,429 per month would be the PIA in my example. 30% less than that puts the benefit at $1,000. So at age 62, you can collect $1,000. Well, that's $429 less than later. So the question becomes, at 67 years old, if you would have claimed, you would have gotten an extra $429 a month for the rest of your life with a cost of living adjustment. Just throw that in there. My question is, what would it cost you? What would you need in assets at 67 in order to generate that $429 a month that you're missing because you claimed $1,000 at age 62? See where I'm going here, folks? We're trying to do an apples-to-apples comparison as much as possible. So the question becomes, what would it cost for $429 a month for the rest of your life? And it's the rest of your life thing that's very, I don't know, maybe not challenging, but confusing for people to try to calculate. You can't assume a certain mortality age because this is income that's guaranteed for life. And so the most appropriate way to look at this is, what would it cost you to buy some extra income that would be guaranteed for the rest of your life? And I'm doing some quick calculations here. I'm looking up for, in Texas, for a female at age 67 to generate this extra income. And we're looking at for another $429 a month. It would take life with cash refund life, $90,000, just over $90,000. Where am I getting that? I'm getting that at a publicly available website called immediateannuities.com. We like it because it's a nice, clean website, not trying to push you into selling you anything. While they do offer that as a service, but they'll give you these quotes without any kind of commitment to buy anything or even ask me for who I am or my information. So I can get this. You can go onto that same website and check it. So it's going to cost $90,000 at 67. Now the question becomes, if I take that $1,000 a month, because remember, if I start at 62, I'm getting $1,000 a month I wouldn't have gotten had I waited to claim at 67. So I need to somehow take that $1,000 a month and invest it and end up with $90,000 when I get to age 67, so that if I wanted to, I could turn around and buy this lifetime annuity of $429. And I'm going to give you this initial example, and it's even not as bad as I'm saying it really is, because there's no inflation adjustment on this quite yet. This is just with a flat $429. So let's look what the implied rate of return you'd have to earn on that $1,000 if you just wanted to replicate $429 a month for the rest of your life, starting at 67, putting you back where you would have been had you waited to take the Social Security. So I'm talking and doing calculator entry at the same time. It's a little confusing, but I'm a professional. Don't try this at home. Let's say, so you've got 5 years, so you've got 60 months that you're going to collect $1,000. And you need $90,000 at the end. You would need to earn 15.58% per year on that investment, whatever it is, in order to earn that. Now, I would say not only that, you need to earn 15.58% guaranteed. Why do I say that? That's because the $429 extra per month you would get by waiting to 67 is guaranteed. If you wait until 67, you're going to get the extra $429. That's a guaranteed outcome. So when you're comparing it to the equivalent investment, you need to use a risk-free investment. It's risk-free waiting to collect the larger amount from Social Security. So on the other hand, you know, to treat it apples to apples, you've got to be risk-free. I don't know where you're going to find a quote, risk-free 15.6% return between now, you know, over the five-year period we're talking about. You know why? I don't know. It doesn't exist. Not even close. Now,
could you maybe do well enough in other investments with risk that you'll end up with 15.58% or better? Maybe. Could be way worse, though, once you open yourself up to risk, and you've only got a five-year time horizon here. You can't take much risk here. You're opening yourself up to maybe having less, right, than you had before. Guess what? As a reminder, the 429 in this quote for $90,000 doesn't give you a inflation adjustment. Social Security does. So guess what? That $90,000, to really replicate the Social Security benefit you'd get at 67, you need to increase that substantially. I will see. I'm going to let Jim talk for a minute, and I can pull up what I mean by substantially more. You're going to need probably 50% more is my guess. So maybe 140, 135. But I'm going to pull that up right now while Jim talks. That's something that's a little too complicated for me to do while I'm talking simultaneously.
What do you want me to talk about? The rest of the question?
I don't know. Add your thoughts to this rabbit hole that we have wandered down. Maybe, you know,
we could have turned this into an EDU show.
We could have. I think I used a simple enough example people can follow along.
Well, I was going to ask you if you wanted to do the rest with, could you do this? I mean, this might be fascinating to our do-it-yourself or Vanguardians, which is 90% of our listeners, to get them to understand this. Do you want to do it as an EDU show, or do you think you can pull this up?
No, I'm close. I'm almost there. So let me just do a couple other things while you share some wisdom of some type. Just say something random or describe your life for the past week or something. I don't know.
Oh, great. And then I'm going to be accused of going on and on and on and get more bad reviews. Again, everyone loves you on the reviews. It's like you're the fireman and I'm the cop.
That's a good way to compare it.
It is. Everyone loves you, and they're either despising me or tolerating me, one or the other. But while you're trying to do that, I can, ask another question, or I could do that.
No, let's not go on to another question. I'm almost there. You've got to have some, your brain is chock full of random stuff. Say something profound.
Oh, geez, you put me on the spot. I was looking
so
through.
When I give you this much pressure, you can't come through?
No, if you want to know the truth, I had the microphone off. And
you
I
weren't
was,
even listening to me,
no,
were
you? No, you were going on and on, and I have no clue what the heck you were saying.
Goodness.
So
that is ridiculous.
I have to admit that I was looking through emails trying to figure out the ones that we were going to answer next.
Okay, so I was a little high, $115,000. So that $90,000, and let me clarify where I got that. The $90,000 figure was to generate $429 a month without any adjustment. So no matter how long you live, it's never going to grow. Well, that's not as good as Social Security. Social Security has a cost of living adjustment. Now, there aren't these annuities with readily available that adjust like Social Security attached to CPI.
There's no more. The last one closed.
Yeah.
You can't get it.
So you have to choose one. So at a 2% cost of living adjustment, which is below the historical average of Social Security, at just a 2% annual adjustment, to get $429 a month starting at age 67 for a female in Texas growing at 2% every year, it wouldn't cost $90,000, it would cost you $115,000. So if you need $115,000 over that five-year period, investing that $1,000 a month that you claimed, and that's what he proposes, he's going to collect it and invest it and do way better than the government could ever give him, he would have to earn 24.28% on an annual basis to end up with $115,000, which is what you would need in today's interest rate environment to generate $429 a month, growing at 2% every year for the rest of her life.
You know, I'm kind of glad you went down this rabbit hole, because I just pulled out a question that I remember receiving a few weeks ago, very similar to this. And you'll see, it's going to be one of the questions that we'll answer. The calculation of what you're talking about, on a similar vein, because what you're essentially doing, and what Chris is, in my opinion, what he's trying to do, is get the net present value of that future income stream and see if you could amass as much money as that net present value of the future income stream. Isn't that what you're essentially doing?
Similar concept. I think the way I walk people through it in this way is a little more easy to understand. because it's simply looking at what would it take as far as a rate of return for me to take that early Social Security at 62 and end up with a pot of money at 67 so that I could replace the extra Social Security benefit that I gave up by claiming early and put me back to square one, put me back to equal. It's going to take you investing that, in my example, $1,000 a month over 60 months, 5 years from 62 to 67, earning 24% per year guaranteed in order for you to just be back where you were with Social Security had you waited until 67. I don't know what math I can do that can more clearly show the true benefit of delaying. Now, just so I can play both sides here, that my own devil's advocate, well, what if I die at 70? Well, you're right. In hindsight, you would have made a bad decision waiting till 67. You should have claimed at the very first date. If you can guarantee me you're going to die at 70, there's no question you claim at 62.
Or in this case, his wife was going to pass away right away.
Right. Whoever's claiming, claim early. If you're going to die that soon, then claiming as early as possible, the math makes perfect sense. But my question is, well, what if you don't? What if you last a lot longer? You're going to have way more benefits in the long haul doing what Social Security does best, longevity protection, longevity risk reduction or coverage. It's a beautiful tool for that. And I would also point out that, say you claimed at 67 and then you pass away at 70, who now you don't care anymore that you made a bad decision because you're no longer around, right? So there's that to consider as well. Now, if you dismiss the value of Social Security, meaning you've got so many other resources that the Social Security is kind of irrelevant, it's not going to make or break me long term, it's not something I'm even relying upon to have a successful retirement, if you're going to treat it as such, then yeah, claim early, harvest what you can, do something else with it that gives you joy or pleasure, or, and I would argue, maybe not necessarily financial benefits, but maybe in your mind some financial benefit, great. But don't pull the rug out from under the older you because you think you're going to, quote, do better than the government. I'm sorry. You show me where you can get a risk-free return of 24% per year. Well, don't try to show me. It doesn't exist. No such thing.
Okay. I think what you did academically is very intriguing. The one place where I think we might have lost a lot of listeners, again, most of our listeners are do-it-yourselfer Vanguardians, and they're just totally into investing and trying to make things grow and getting money and put it to quote-unquote work. Mm-hmm. Even though what you say is compelling, I don't know if we would be able to change people's minds, but I think what we did do, especially what you did just now, is give them more food for thought, different yeah. way to look at this. I just keep thinking back to that email we got about 5-6 weeks ago now from an engineer who, remember, he had a problem. I can't remember what it was. And he says, so I wrote a spreadsheet to figure it out because that's what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so all you do-it-yourselfers, write some spreadsheets. Start calculating like Chris is looking at, and maybe, just maybe, it'll make you think twice on claiming Social Security earlier if you think you're going to invest that money and do better than what the government is going to promise you. But let's get to the meat and potato of his actual question, because that went it. That was just a rabbit hole that you went down.
No, you dug the hole. I just volunteered to go inside.
I can never keep you out of rabbit. See, I am pithy. I stay on topic. And answer the questions in as little words as possible.
I'll try to be more succinct.
You got to be more like me.
Okay, I'll try.
You, on the other hand, you get a little flaky.
I live my life to try to be more like you, Jim.
You should. You get a little flaky at times. You go on and on and on. You pronounce words that you don't know how to say. So, no, you got to change your act. But anyways, let's get you back on track here.
Okay.
So, in case you all forgot what Chris was talking about, the wife is 52, the husband is 45, the husband is the one writing to us. Mm-hmm. Remember, folks, in case you missed out, they are self-employed. They control their own W-2 income that they pay each mm-hmm. or pay themselves. So his main question was this. We are looking at taking my wife's Social Security at 62, and again, he shares with us because he feels he can invest it and earn more than what the government's going to give him. So he asks, if I change her pay to match or beat her highest earning years currently on her record, will it make a difference in her PIA since there are only 10 years to go? The most she has ever made has been about $41,000, with many of her previous years only earning $25,000 to $30,000. Mm-hmm. What if I bump her up to $45,000, maybe even more? Will that make a big change in her PIA? I have her at $24 per year now, with 60% of $24 per year. I think he meant $24,000 per year. I could be wrong. Actually, this doesn't even make any sense, this whole sentence. He's just telling us what she's doing with her money. She's putting 60% in a Roth 401k, 40% into a regular 401k. That doesn't, I don't think, matter at this point in time. Mm-hmm. But his main question, could he manipulate her earnings and just pay $45,000 a year? Oh, yes. So she's at $24,000 a year now, and I guess he could bump her to $45,000 a year since her previous earnings were in the $25,000 to $30,000 and a couple of years around $40,000, $41,000. So then he says, thanks for all you guys do. Jim, keep up the elk hunting and stay out of the hospital, will you? And come to Texas sometimes, and I'll take you hog hunting for 300-pound wild hogs. Mm. So I may take him up on that. I always wanted to go hog hunting. I know in Texas they get a lot of hogs. But I don't know if I want a 300-pound hog. I always would imagine the smaller ones would taste better. And then I just have to read this line because it's almost like he read your mind. He says, Chris, thanks for always taking us down those rabbit holes. And he put a little smiley face. And please, let's make it 2 Q&A shows per week.
Oh, I got another one today that said don't do that.
Oh, come on, so really?
Everyone you get, I have an offsetting one. I swear, I'm not making this up. I got another one today.
You're not sending them to yourself?
No, I'm not.
Seems every time I get someone voting to go to 2 a week, you mysteriously... So
it's balanced.
Get one that says not to.
Yeah, I get it.
All right. So, but anyways, back to his question.
Back to the question. Let's give him an answer now that we're 27 minutes into the show. This is the first question?
It's technically the second question because you created a question out of thin air.
So the answer to this question is it could, but you can't look at it the way he's looking at it. What you're going to have to do in order to replace prior years in the earnings record with a higher earning year, thus increasing the calculation for the PIA, is to have a number bigger than a previous indexed earnings year. What that means is you mentioned she made some years, you know, the highest about $40,000, usually about $25,000 or something. Well, $40,000 15 years ago is the equivalent of a lot more today. So to replace that in the record, you can think of it as this, that $40,000 from 15 years ago is contributing far more than $40,000 on an indexed or inflation adjusted basis in the AMI, which leads to the PIA calculation. So what you'd have to do is go and adjust those prior earnings for the wage inflation and then pay her more than some of those previous years in order to increase it. And the key is not necessarily paying her more than the higher years. You just need to pay her more than some of those low years that might be captured in her 35 years of earnings that they consider for the actual calculation. So what you're really trying to do is eliminate low years that are dragging down the benefit as much as anything. And so that's what I would try to do, is kind of look at her overall indexed wages. And you can make the adjustment if you look, if you Google Social Security indexing factors for earnings, is you can get some information on how you might adjust for that. If you actually go to the National Average Wage Index page at Social Security, you can see what the wage indexing
figures are. In other words, what are the inflation and wages that they're using to adjust those prior years? And I will tell you that based on current information, let me go back and look. So maybe 20 years before 2019, so 1999 isn't quite half. Half is 1997. So if she's got earnings of $40,000 in 1997, that's the equivalent of $80,000 in 2019-2020 period. So that's what you have to be looking at to compare. Don't look at just the nominal or the face value of those previous earnings in her earnings record. You have to index them for inflation and then look at them all in current year terms to make a better judgment as to what that's going to look like. Now, that can be a little complicated. It might be easier just to use one of the online Social Security calculations that are out there and plug in her earnings record and then plug in some future earnings just as a test. Just play around with it and say, well, what if I pay her $60,000 a year over the next 10 years? What is that going to look like for her benefit? Well, what does it look like if I only pay her 50? Or what if I pay her 80? You know, play around with it and you'll start to see how much difference that extra pay is going to make in her Social Security benefit. That would be the easiest way, unless you're an engineer and you want to write an Excel spreadsheet to deal with this. You could do that as well. But that's what I need you to understand is you can't look at it just on face value. You've got to index those previous earnings years to make a valid comparison. Probably more simply, just use one of the online Social Security calculators and put in some forecasted future earnings for her and see what happens. That'd be the best way to do it, in my opinion.
That's a very good point you made there. Uh-oh.
Why'd you say uh-oh?
Because my old little iPad, not that new one that I talked to you about earlier, I got the white screen of Apple death where it just goes white and you get the little black Apple.
Yeah.
And I was in the process of trying.
Crashed.
Yeah. I was in the process of trying to look up a quote on immediate annuities, but I will have you do it.
I can do that. I have the technology.
I thought you could. What would someone in Massachusetts, age 65, with $57,000.
So do I need inflation adjustment or no?
Negative. Okay. Just what would someone in Massachusetts, age 65, get with $57,000?
Just a single person?
He does not specify the numbers he gave me.
Okay. And how old did you say?
Will be 65 when he begins receiving the income.
In Massachusetts.
Massachusetts.
I'll be there 1 second.
All right. Well, Chris,
immediately, how much?
No. Well, you figure that out. I'll read his question.
How much?
$57,000.
Okay.
As the lump sum that he's putting in.
Okay.
Okay. He begins. Hi, Jim and Chris. I'm 61, and I know he's 61 now. You'll see in a minute why I told you he was 65. Mm-hmm. I'm 61 and live in Massachusetts. Before my employer went to a 401k, I had a pension that has been frozen. Mm-hmm. He goes on to explain he's receiving $150 a month from that frozen pension. But he went on and said, at age 65, in addition, I can receive a lump sum of $57,000 or an additional life annuity for $335 a month. Mm-hmm. Would you take the additional life annuity payments or roll the $57,000 into an IRA and let it grow? Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering what a 65-year-old would be able to receive with $57,000 living in the state of Massachusetts as a life annuity.
Ready for the results?
I am.
$57,000 in Massachusetts for a single male, lifetime income guaranteed, right at $280 a month if you give the company $57,000.
Okay.
Which means that the pension is offering him about 20% more income than what an equivalent annuity, or taking that lump sum and putting it into an annuity. Let me add a little footnote, I guess. That's based on current, as in today's interest rates. If interest rates are higher by the time he gets to 65,
the payout might be bigger, might be closer to that 3.35. But if interest rates are lower, it'll actually be worse than the 2.80. The annuity income is going to be based at the time on interest rates at the time you purchase the annuity. So in today's environment where interest rates are quite low, this is a fairly typical situation where the pension payout is better than an equivalent annuity. This is quite typical in this day and age because a lot of the pensions are not affected as much by interest rates, sometimes not at all.
Well, they're not because your payments from a pension are based on your salary and replacing a portion of your salary.
Correct.
Whereas the annuity is based on current interest rates.
Correct. So that's the difference in annuity versus pension income. When interest rates are really high, a lot of times the annuities can beat what the pension is willing to pay out. But in times like this, it's not as good.
I haven't seen annuities beat pensions in a
very long time.
Yeah, it just, you very, very, very rarely see it, folks. So back to this gentleman's question, which is more of a planning question. Mm-hmm. I wanted Chris to crunch these numbers, listener, just to give you an idea that $57,000 is not a whole heck of a lot of money. Neither is $335 a month. We admit all that. But your question was to us, would we take the $335 a month or $57,000 up front? I can't tell you what we would do, but what I could tell you is what you need to consider. And one of the things I wanted to show you was that the pension is probably paying you more lifetime guaranteed income than you're going to be able to replicate on your own. If you don't need additional lifetime guaranteed secure income, if you don't need the $335 a month, it is not needed at all. Mm-hmm. You've got your minimum dignity floor covered with enough income. This $335 is not needed. One could argue then, if you have other things you would like to do, perhaps the lump sum makes more sense, especially if you were going to try to maybe optimize an inheritance or you had a very low life expectancy. Mm-hmm. You don't think you're going to live a very long time and you're crunching the numbers to figure out when you're going to quote unquote break even. It could very well be that taking the lump sum makes sense. But if you are short on lifetime guaranteed income and you're wondering if you should take this lump sum and then somehow invest it and be able to purchase even additional lifetime income, I don't think you're going to be able to beat that. And Chris spent some time talking earlier on that with the other gentleman with his Social Security idea as well of investing. So I can't answer, and I'll let Chris opine in a second. I honestly, listen, I can't tell you if you should take the lump sum or not. I wanted to figure out, is the income payments a decent offer? Mm-hmm. And based on what you shared with us, right now it appears it could be. Mm-hmm. Now, you wouldn't know for sure until 4 years, because the annuity quote that we got for you was based on current interest rates, as Chris already said. In 4 years, if interest rates are higher than they are today, you will likely get more money than what Chris quoted. If they're lower than they are today, you might get less money than what Chris quoted, making the pension even more valuable. Mm-hmm. So it's a calculation you have to do in 4 years, not now. It's nice that you're thinking of it now, but I think the true calculation should be based in 4 years. And you're going to have to really base it on not just the younger you. You're only 61. When you retire, you're going to be 65. We may feel old at 65, but relative to the 85-year-old you, you're going to be young. So what does the 85-year-old you have to say about this? You really need to look at it through the eyes of an older person. Would the 85-year-old you like steady, easy income coming in every month that doesn't have to be dealt with, doesn't have to be invested? They may. Perhaps the 85-year-old you isn't going to need that money and you want to kind of optimize some type of inheritance. So it's a tough call. But another option you could do is perhaps take the income, and if you don't need it, invest the income every month steadily into a very simplified, well-diversified investment. Very good moderate allocation mutual fund, perhaps, or whatever allocation matches your risk tolerance. If you don't need the money, you're guaranteeing the older you some secure income if they ever need it, and slowly growing an investment portfolio as well if you ever need that. So it's kind of the King Solomon approach. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer, listener. I just wanted to get an idea if the current payment that they're offering, $335 a month on a $57,000 lump sum at 65, seemed worth it or not. I think it is, but the ultimate decision is going to be up to you. What do you think, Chris?
I think a lot of times we're trying to do a financial value on different choices, which is totally legitimate to consider, but also consider the emotional value or personal value you have on something. If you need the income long term, if you're really needing some sort of income, I think the pension is going to make more sense because you get that 20% more in today's environment, you know, compared to today's annuity quotes. And so that income might be very beneficial to have in the long term. If having that doesn't really affect challenge or put at risk your ability to cover your most important expenses long term, if you do have longevity, if that's not a worry or the case, and you could really do something that you would value today if you had that, you know, at 65, if you had that $57,000 as a lump sum, maybe you've always dreamed about doing something while you were young enough. Maybe, you know, a world cruise is always the example that comes up. Something like that, which you can't do if you take the $335 a month, because it'll take way too long for that money to come in. And by the time you pile it up, you'll be too old to go do it. It provides you this personal value that's so significant that could sway the attractiveness more towards taking the lump sum. But always keep in mind, we don't encourage you to jeopardize the coverage of what we call your minimum dignity floor, your most important expenses. Don't jeopardize that being covered by secure income if this is a key component. This $335 a month, the pension we're talking about, is a key component to that. If you're relying on that to meet that role in your overall retirement plan, then you kind of have to ignore the personal benefit. It doesn't outweigh the real need for longevity protection. If that's not an issue, though, let your personal decision, you know, your personal value rather than just a purely financial value play a big part in the decision is all I would encourage people to do.
I would agree on that, especially the what gives you peace of mind. We run by that all the time, folks, when listeners, colleagues, friends, clients ask us about prepaying a mortgage down. And you can sit there and crunch the numbers nine times to Sunday and factor in the tax deductibility of the interest and all this other hokey stuff that they do. And to me, it all comes down to, would you feel better if the mortgage was paid off? Oh, I absolutely would love it if it was paid off. Then pay it off. There's, to me, no right or wrong answer. And there's no right or wrong answer to this question, Chris. Because ultimately, when you die, you're never going to know if you made the right decision or not. And does it matter? Is it going to get you a better seat at the right hand of God if you made more money off of this $57,000 by taking it early and investing it, or taking it as a lifetime stream of income? No. And that's, I think, one of the things that these do-it-yourselfers fall victim to. They look only at the financial side of things and not necessarily at the emotional side of things.
Right.
But also, folks, always look at things through the eyes of the older you. This gentleman's 61, not that far after age 53. We talk about age 53 all the time. According to Harvard University, that's the pinnacle age of the human brain for understanding financial concepts. After 53, it is degrading. It degrades slowly at first, but rapidly begins to degrade as you get into your 70s, 80s, and 90s. You often have to look at life through the eyes of the 80, 85, 90-year-old you? And what are they going to want to be doing? And how well will they be able to be doing it? Are they going to want to be managing a portfolio, managing a bigger IRA, larger RMDs? Or are they going to really like just $335 bucks a month coming in? Granted, it doesn't buy much, and it's going to buy even less in 30 years or 20 years from now. We get that. But is it going to be easier for the older you to handle? I constantly remind clients of that, constantly remind our employees, especially the two younger junior that we have with us. Don't look at the advice we give people through the eyes of 25-year-olds. Look at it through the eyes of 50, 60, 70, 80, 90-year-olds. That's probably one of the hardest things they have to do here. They don't even know people. I'm like their father, for Pete's sakes, and they don't know people in their 70s and 80s. That's like grandparents. They probably don't even have grandparents that old. So it's one of the things that we have to constantly get people to understand. It's one of the reasons I'm thinking of moving. It's not because the 57-year-old Jim hates Colorado. I'll complain about it being incessantly dry and poor gardening weather all the time, but I love it when I'm up in the Rockies, Chris, hiking. But I am contemplating moving to the East Coast and a hardwood forest with more rain because the older Jim, the 75, 80, 85-year-old Jim, is going to like it. It's because I want to garden as I age. My decision is being driven by my younger me trying to make the life of my 75, 80, 85-year-old me better. And it would be selfish of the younger me not to factor that into any decision. And if I only drove my decision based on, I love the Rockies and I want to go elk hunting all the time and hiking all the time and to hell with gardening. If that was my decision, I'm really not being nice to the older me. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm making, I mean, Chris jokes with me moving, but he knows deep down this is why I'm doing it and considering it. It's not that I despise Colorado. I just don't think the 75, 80, 85-year-old Jim is going to be happy here as the 40, 50-year-old Jim was. So it's the same thing with this question and all the questions like it. Should I take the lump sum? Should I take the income? You all do-it-yourselfers are just analyzing the financial aspect. What's the break-even? And what is this? And how much more am I going to get? And I can earn this. Stop for a minute, will you? And look at this through the eyes of an 80, 85, 90-year-old. And you've got to factor in that with your decision. So anyways, that's all I want to share on that, which ties into a couple more questions. Now, we went long on that rabbit hole. Do you have time to get a couple more questions?
At least one more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Hopefully, we can get these two in. But we'll start. I want to get to this one. It wasn't the question that I wanted to get to. This other question has been waiting for a while. But anyways, this is a question that kind of ties into the little rabbit hole you went down earlier on the Social Security part. It's not 100% close to it, but it has to do again with net present value and how to look at income streams. So it's a neat concept this guy has. And again, I don't think there's going to be a right or wrong answer to this gentleman's question, Chris. I think if you put 10 financial advisors in a room and 10 do-it-yourselfers in a room, you'll have 20 different answers. I don't think there is a right or wrong answer. But let me get to his scenario. Good food for thought for everyone paying attention today. Okay. Hi, Jim and Chris. Thanks for your podcast and the valuable information you share with us listeners. I would like to get your thoughts on how to incorporate Social Security and a pension into the fixed income portion of a portfolio. Would you recommend this approach I am considering? As an example, go ahead and use the following information. We have $1.5 million in retirement and taxable accounts. We want to take 4% a year from it, or $60,000. We have another $60,000 of guaranteed income. $40,000 a year combined through our Social Security and $20,000 per year in a pension. So fairly straightforward series of facts he's laying out. Kind of 50-50, Chris. Mm-hmm. He goes on to say, this $120,000 in total income will come half from pension, half from Social Security. We want to maintain a 50-50 moderate allocation in retirement with 50% in equity and 50% in fixed income. He says, let me see, I lost my place in line, 50% in fixed income. If 50% of the fixed income need was to be considered covered with my pension and Social Security, do you think we could invest 100% of our portfolio into equities to cover the other 50%? He says, if you do not agree with this approach, I would appreciate hearing your thoughts on how you would incorporate pension and Social Security into the equity versus fixed income portion of a portfolio. Mm-hmm. Let me answer first before you answer your way.
Okay.
This concept, listener and listeners in general, I have been exposed to through my CFP studies at Boston University, through the readings that I do. It's not universally accepted, and it's not often done the way he's calculating it. But I have heard arguments that when you put an allocation together, a person's fixed income, Social Security and pension in this case, should be considered. And I have heard arguments it should not be considered. I tend to be in that camp, that it should not be considered. The way he's considering it, I don't know if it's completely correct, that rationalization way. I would really want to know what the net present value of $60,000 of income would be. And is it truly a net present value worth $1.5 million? And that truly would give the 50-50? You follow what I'm saying, Chris?
I'm following you.
So that's how I think he has to do it. And I didn't do the calculation because it's going to depend on what discount rate you want to use, listener. Are you going to use a risk-free rate, maybe tied to the T-bill, which would really skew the numbers? Or are you going to use a high potential rate of return that you think you might get in a moderate portfolio or a 100% equity portfolio? What discount rate do you use to come up with what the net present value is? Mm-hmm. I think that's the way you would need to do it, and that's the way it's always been presented when I've listened to arguments in favor of this, that an advisor should take the net present value of a client's income stream and relay to the client that that's the equivalent of their fixed income portion of the portfolio. I just don't think $60,000 a year is going to take $1.5 million, so I don't know if it's quite 50-50. Depending again on what discount rate you decide to use. But it's always been presented that way, listener, not based on the income. Gee, I'm going to take half my income from a portfolio and half my income from secure income, Social Security and pension. Therefore, that's my 50-50 mix. So if it's my 50-50 mix, I can put 100% of my portfolio in equities. I've never heard it presented that way. I'm not saying that some advisors don't look at it mm-hmm. that way. Mm-hmm. I would look at it instead as a net present value, and you'd have to come up with a reasonable discount rate that matches your opinion, listener, to see if $60,000 a year of income is truly representative of $1.5 million of a lump sum. But let me tell you why I don't do it as an investment manager. I don't do it as a financial planner, and I don't do it as an investment manager for one simple reason. Emotions. Clients, you are rationally thinking of this, listener, right now. You are sitting in a 12-year bull market without a meaningful correction. And please, I know you don't have to send me the emails. I know a correction is a drop of 20% or more. I know the market has done that several times over the past 12 years, but there has been no prolonged correction. all corrections have immediately been bailed out by the Fed, or just lasted a few weeks and then came back and they were more blips than any type of meaningful correction. So he's looking at this, Chris, rationally. Stocks are only going up. They're making so much money. Why not do this? I, as a financial planner and an investment manager, have to deal with the irrational people. When markets all of a sudden start to go down, when they might only be going down for a few days and people are already panicking, calling up our office, wondering if they should take money out of the market. And from an irrational standpoint, I don't like this. I don't like trying to remind a client that, hey, don't forget to look at your pension and your Social Security has pot bonds, and that actually represents X amount of hundreds of thousands of dollars. So if we factor that into your $1.5 million portfolio that just dropped 50% and you only got $750,000 left, because he's talking about putting it all in equities, Chris, and you only got $750,000 left, don't panic too much because you still have these bonds over here. But now he's also trying to draw $60,000 a month from a portfolio that just lost 50%. And it could really keep that portfolio from ever rebounding, and it's going to continue to run out, and his whole well-laid plans just went to hell in a handbasket. So I personally would never do it. But what are your thoughts, Chris?
Well, let me drive down the road that the two of you are on a little bit further before I do a hard U-turn and go back to a fundamental question, which I think is at issue here. When doing this, turning the $60,000 a year into an equivalent lump sum fixed income portfolio description, that, you know, net present value idea, that's a present value idea, depending on how you look at it, the variables, like Jim mentioned, are important. What discount rate are you going to use? How are you going to do this? But the variables are vastly more complicated than that. First of all, this income is not quite the same as a fixed income portfolio because of a lack of liquidity. You don't have the ability to draw upon it in any form other than taking the $60,000 per year. You at no time could sell a bond from there and protect, maybe take to fill in some of the gap from the big drop in the equities like Jim just mentioned. You don't have that, so right there it's not the same. Secondly, the income streams, there's a lot of variation that's going to go on here. You didn't mention if the pension has a cost of living adjustment. Let's assume it doesn't. You also didn't mention, does it have, what's the survivorship option on there, if any? Social Security, you said the combined Social Security was $40,000, but part of that's going to go away at the first passing. So it isn't, you can't just use these total numbers and project it out till you both living to X, you know, X age. It's most likely one of you is going to die before the other. You got to start factoring in the value of those variables. So you can see there's a lot of moving parts here you'd have to consider, but let's take the U-turn. I think the fundamental initial question is wrong. Let's go back to the 50-50. My question to him or her would be, why did you decide on a 50-50? Seems somewhat arbitrary. A lot of investment approaches are pretty arbitrary, and they'll use rules of thumb like you should have fixed income portfolio in a percentage equal to your age. So as you age, it gets bigger and bigger. Now, there's been a lot of arguments that maybe that makes sense as you age to a certain point, but then it can go the other direction as you get much, much older because you don't have that many years left. There's a whole other discussion there. But why did you arrive at this 50-50? How do you know that is the right blend or allocation for you, other than, oh, that seems like a reasonable allocation for a retiree? That's not the way we propose that you think of it. You need to ask yourself, what do these resources need to do for me and when? The answer to those two questions will tell you where you should put this money, not some arbitrary 50-50. That's somewhat lazy approach. Maybe it'll work out, maybe it won't, but it's not specific to your situation. You could have all these academic arguments about the reasonableness of this, and I think you could support that this is a reasonable 50-50 is a reasonable approach to allocation for retirement, but it isn't addressing your specific needs, in particular if you want to make sure to protect and kind of extract as much benefit from your assets that you've built in your go-go years, in the early years. If you're looking at this as, oh, even spending over a 30-year period, that makes a lot of these assumptions pretty simple to approach. But when you're trying to go-go real heavily, you can't leave a lot of this extra money, this $1.5 million you're talking about leaving in equities. That's way too risky, because the $60,000 probably isn't going to fund. That'll fund a lot of minimum dignity floor expenses, but it's not going to fund a lot of, quote, fun or desired expenses. And if you have dreams of doing a whole bunch of stuff in the next 5-6 years, the last thing you want to do is be pulling that, like Jim mentioned, from a portfolio that suddenly drops by 30, 40, 50%. You might cause irreparable harm to that portion of your portfolio. That I think is the question at hand. Why are you choosing 50-50? Let other factors, other than the arbitrary approach I think you're using by choosing 50-50, let your needs, what you need the money to do for you and when, be the key driver in what allocation you need. And then that secure income will play a very obvious role in that, what do I need this money to do for me and when? Because you'll see it's going to handle those long-term expenses that go until you die. The secure income is perfect for covering those because it's income that comes in until you die. Then you carve out the rest and deal with the way we talk about all the time on the show. But yeah. I would attack that 50-50 first and make sure you actually want a 50-50.
I would encourage him not only that, though, Chris. I would be against what he's contemplating doing, and it's only because of the emotional aspect. But also you can do the investment aspect as well, as Chris and I are trying to get you to understand. We were talking the sequential risk. If you start to suffer losses and your 750 drops a lot, which it would, being 100% invested in equities, withdrawing $60,000 a year from that, unless you are willing to cut the spending that is going on. If we were to use the average minimum dignity floor early in retirement, which is what I assume he's going to be hit with, is going to be between $60,000 and $100,000. So the $60,000 of income that he's getting, let's even assume that does cover his minimum dignity floor. Mm-hmm. So his Social Security and pension will cover that. What it's going to leave, listener, is $60,000 coming from a $1.5 million portfolio that you're contemplating putting 100% in equities, which could drop 30, 40, 50% quite quickly. The S&P dropped 38% in 6 weeks when COVID hit. It then only took 6 or 7 weeks to rebound, so nobody even remembers that. But the market can drop significantly and huge. You would emotionally freak out on that, listener. And what are you going to cut? Your fun spending. And is that what you want to do early in retirement? Not do what you retired to do because the market is down? I would be against what you are contemplating. And when you retire, folks, this listener included, stop using the rules of accumulation that took you to retirement when it comes to managing your portfolio and overanalyzing. I want 50% in stocks, 50% in bonds, and start looking at positioning. If it were me, and I had $1.5 million plus $60,000 of secure income, I'd make sure that $60,000 of secure income, adjusted for potential inflationary pressures in the future, tied to my minimum dignity floor, was going to be enough to take care of my minimum dignity floor forever. If it's not, figure out what the shortage is. Figure out how much you need to reserve for that shortage and take it from that $1.5 million, put it off to the side, keep it invested. I mean, put it off to the side, mentally account for it, make it very safe and off limits to any spending. But then I would look at the remaining money, and even if it is the remaining $1.5 million, I wouldn't like you positioning $1.5 million, 100% into equities that you have to draw income from, especially 12 years into a bull market that hasn't yet corrected sustainably for 1.5 to 3 years, which is what a healthy bull market needs to correct. And it should do that at least every decade, and we haven't. This market needs to correct. A correction is healthy for the market. It truly is. You all know that. You do-it-yourselfers, you know a correction is healthy. Where it hurts retirees is when the market is down. Chris, you're going to what? Oh, my God, I'm not going to spend the money, or I can't get as much out. It's not going to last as long. So you have to cut fund spending. Time that you may never get back. And you could be faced with a medical situation. Trust me, folks, I'm the wrong person to say bad things don't happen medically. Y'all know my medical history over the last 6 months. Things can happen at any time. I don't want to cut my fund spending, Chris, when I get older because my portfolio is down. So I don't think he should have $1.5 million in all equities. I don't think he should have it even in fixed income. Fixed income can lose as well. He needs to position his fund spending very safely. So no matter what the economy is doing, whatever what the markets are doing, he and his wife and his family are still going to be able to do the fund that they want to. Anyways, I don't want to go too deeply into that, but it gets into my philosophy that positioning your assets for spending is risk mitigation. And once investment risk mitigation is what I'm talking, and emotional risk mitigation. And once you are properly positioned and you know your fund spending is protected, your aging needs are protected, your guaranteed inheritance, if it's important to you, is protected, money you're going to need for the minimum dignity floor and money for a reserve buffer, all of these things that Chris and I preach in our process incessantly, once all that is protected, then you can figure out how much of that remaining $1.5 million is actually earmarked for fun. And then you got to ask yourself, are you willing to cut your fun because the market drops and emotionally you don't want to spend, and academically it would pain your portfolio to spend $60,000 a year from something that's now worth only $750,000. So you cut your fun spending. And you're going to wait maybe a year or two or three or maybe six, like the 08 crash took, to break even. You might not be able to do fun things after the end of that wait. So that's part of the issues I have with what he's contemplating. He's taking theories, concepts, academic proposals of an accumulation portfolio and a totally rational, never irrational thinking process, and trying to apply real life distribution, emotional volatility. And it doesn't work that way. So anyways, that's what I would recommend he look at.
Yep.
Perfect. All right. This is a real short pro rata question. I just want to get to it. The gentleman doesn't quite understand pro rata. You got a real quick second on pro rata?
Yeah.
Okay. Quick. So he says, hello. For the sake of getting to the stack, for the sake of getting to the top stack of Jim's email, I am going to say I'm in Kentucky.
At least he's honest.
Even though I have never been there. But I did drive through it a few times, and it seems very nice. So I think he's playing off of what you said, that people are going to start saying they're from Kentucky or Ohio just to get to the top of my list.
I don't blame them. They're desperate to get their questions answered.
Anyways, he says, I've listened to about 10 podcasts, but this one is the only one I immediately open when I see there's a new episode. And my question is about the pro rata rule. Mm-hmm. I think I understand it, but after recently reading an article, I'm guessing myself and wondering if I made a tax boo-boo. Listener, I don't think you made a boo-boo at all. I just don't think you understand pro rata. Let me explain. Here's his question, Chris. From 2000 to 2018, he writes, I was employed and contributed all pre-tax money to a 401k. Then in 2018, I switched and started contributing to my Roth 401k instead of my pre-tax 401k. Mm-hmm. But my company matched, continue to go into the pre-tax 401k.
Mm-hmm. As it has to.
As it has to. Mm-hmm. So far, no problem, Chris, correct?
No problem and no pro rata issues.
No pro rata issues. Nope. Exactly, folks. So far, no problem here at all. Okay. I switched companies last October. And when I did, I moved my 401k to an IRA. and my Roth 401k to a Roth IRA. Mm-hmm. So far, no problem, Chris, correct?
Still no problem. It's
exactly.
Beautifully clean.
Exactly. Okay. In December, I did a Roth conversion of $100,000 from my IRA, the one that he just moved over. $100,000 from my IRA. Mm-hmm. And in January, I paid all the taxes I owed from money I had in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Still no problem.
Still no problem. Still no pro rata.
Nope. Exactly. So everything you're describing, listener, is perfectly fine. So then he said, here's his question. Since I only made contributions as traditional pre-tax 401k, and recently as the Roth 401k, I thought I would have avoided the pro rata issue since I did not put any post-tax, non-Roth voluntary contributions into my 401k.
Right.
And that's correct, listener.
Correct.
You didn't do any of that.
Right.
So you did everything perfectly. You did not put any after-tax money into that 401k. He says, but now I'm second guessing this.
Stop. Don't second guess.
Let me finish.
Okay, sorry.
What I forgot to calculate is the company match. Where does that fit in? Mm. How does the company match factor into all this?
It doesn't.
Do you want to tell him?
It doesn't at all. It's just more pre-tax contribution to your traditional 401k that ended up in your IRA. That IRA has 100% pre-tax money in it. There is no after-tax money in that IRA. And it's the after-tax basis in the IRA that creates the pro rata issue. You don't have any. Everything you walked through, you've got two clean buckets. You've got a clean traditional IRA bucket with all pre-tax money in it, both your contributions, company contributions, and growth that has never been taxed. You have a pool of Roth money that originally was in the Roth 401k rolled out, and then you did a conversion of some of the traditional IRA over to the Roth. No pro rata to be seen anywhere, horizon to horizon.
Exactly. And then he asks one final question. Mm-hmm. Now with the conversion, does this mean I have an issue with the Roth and pro rata?
No.
I'll answer that part.
Okay,
no, listener. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. Roth money is in separate little pools, if you will. There's no pro rata issues for the most part with Roth. There can be with some, well, actually, I don't even want to go down that road at all. So I'll stick with my initial assessment. There's no pro rata issues with a Roth. What they're going to look at is what money is taxed. Well, the only money that's taxed in a Roth, for the most part, is the growth. The money you put in, your contributions, can come out at any time for any reason, no taxes, no penalties. So your contributions come out first, then the $100,000 conversion, and only after the contributions and the conversion has been removed would the growth be left. There's no pro rata. When you take a withdrawal from a Roth, it's not a little bit of contribution, a little bit of conversion, and a little bit of growth. It's separate pools. It does not pro rata like it would in an IRA and the issues you get into an IRA. Contributions come out first, 100% tax and penalty free. Conversions come out next, 100% tax free, maybe, maybe not, 100% penalty free.
Right.
Depends how long it was in the Roth and how old you are.
No, how long it was in the traditional IRA. I'm sorry, how long it was in the Roth. You're
yes,
right.
Because it was conversion.
Yes, yes, yes.
And then you have the growth.
Right.
The growth will always be subject to income taxes and a 10% penalty if you take it out prior to age 59 and a half. And if the Roth was younger than 5 years old. You need both of those combined. But once you hit 59 and a half and your Roth is 5 years old, the growth is 100% tax-free.
Right.
So no pro rata issues with that. And then he ends with, if I have a problem, what do I have to do to fix it? you ain't got a problem.
No.
So relax. You got nothing to fix.
Exactly.
Overanalyzed it. Oh, this is a good news one. Glad we could help you with that. You did everything fine. You understand pro rata. Don't worry about the growth. And when it comes to taking money out of the Roth, just remember contributions first, then conversions, then growth. And you track all of that on Form 8606, that wonderful ubiquitous form that we talk about for tracking basis in an IRA. You use to track withdrawals from a Roth. And that's where you keep track of your contributions coming out first, then your conversions, then your growth. So you'll do it all on that wonderful form 8606.
Right. Perfect.
That's it.
Well, that's a nice close. Good news close to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. We do appreciate all those good questions that were sent in. I know we've got a slew of other ones. So next week, we've already got stuff lined up.
It's a tax Q&A next week with Bob.
We'll have tax questions to deal with the next week.
No Social Security questions next week. We're going to begin straight away with tax questions with Bob.
Are you sure you want to do that? Seems like such a deviation from tradition.
Yeah, but we don't get Bob on the show all the time, especially lately with his crown always acting up and he can't talk too well.
Okay.
So we're going to get him on the show.
So a tax-focused Q&A next week.
Tax-focused Q&A. If all goes well, if Bob can talk, if he doesn't keep breaking his crown... We'll let him explain how he chews apparently really hard. But assuming his mouth is fine and he can talk, Bob is coming on to answer a slew of tax-related questions.
Okay, perfect. So if you want to send in your own questions for future shows after next week, go to the website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, you can find a contact form to submit any questions. You can also learn a little bit more about us if you haven't learned enough on the podcast. And then as an alternative for your questions, you can always email directly to Jim. His email address is jim@jimhelps.com. We really appreciate everybody listening, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.